Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Nothing like it before, nothing like it since. Murder, Inc. was the most unusual, brutal, and extensive collection of characters the American underworld had ever produced. Culled primarily from Brooklyn's Brownsville and Ocean Hill sections, these official on-call killers of New York's larger crime syndicate were a unified force of Jewish and Italian gangsters that treated murder as an art form for an entire decade. They were called mobsters, thugs, hoods, and racketeers, but at the very core, they were assassins. When gangland kingpins such as Louis Lepke Buchalter, Charles Lucky Luciano, and Benjamin Bugsy Siegel needed a contract fulfilled, the Combination Boys would eagerly take to task the enforcement duties, which included methods ranging from gunfire to fire axes, incineration to ice picks. These are the mysteries, the sordid stories, the character profiles, alluring and lesser-known tales of the mob's most deadly hit squad. Meet the killers, the victims, the bosses, the lovers, the deceivers, and the gangsters that made up a nationally reaching ensemble cast, rivaling anything organized crime or law enforcement had ever imagined to that point in time. Discover the nuances, the attitudes, the motivations, the ambitions, and thanks to Little Honor Among Thieves, the scathing revelations that lead to an inevitable downfall. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder, Inc., Mysteries of the Mob's Most Deadly Hit Squad, with my special guest, journalist and author, Christian Cipollini. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Christian Cipollini.
Dan, thank you for having me again. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, and it's always a pleasure, and we'll get right into this most extraordinary tale. For everybody that thinks they know about the mob, this is one more layer of understanding, I believe. Incredible. Now, you start off by explaining that the mob was not designed, not organized, not operated for the purpose of killing. What was the purpose of, you know, what was the purpose of the mob? And before we get into Murder, Inc. itself.
Basic economics, to make money. The mob existed for achieving the American dream, just in a different way than legitimate society did. It wasn't about killing or being brutal, tough guys. That comes with it, you know, because it's such an illegitimate thing they were doing. But no, it was about making money. It was that simple.
Now, you say that, like any organization, even legitimate corporations, they operated the same way. They would have accounts payable, they'd have public relations, they'd have logistics, and then they would have an enforcement arm. So we always know that there's somebody who's going to do the dirtiest of dirty work. Tell us about that. How did that come to be, and how did they pick people for enforcement? How did that work?
It's such a mind-boggling, but, I don't know, simplistic in a way, dynamic to the whole thing. They needed a self-policing unit, I suppose. What happened, the short version is, the guys who were becoming big time, like Luciano, Lansky, Buchalter, all those guys, some of them had been watching these younger hoods and what they had achieved on their own. And it sort of evolved into the situation where they figured these guys would be good at handling the really nasty stuff. And they brought them in. These younger guys were looking to make a name for themselves, and they were doing that. And the established guys saw it happen. They saw what was happening. So that's sort of why they selected them.
None of these people were really shy from murdering anyone in sort of the course of doing business. But what were the things that really brought to attention these guys, that this enforcement arm, what were the kind of infractions that were just not going to be, not going to be brushed aside? What would bring the enforcement arm, this team of guys, to your door? What kind of rules were you not to ever break?
Well, obviously, if you were suspected of speaking to law enforcement, if you stole from the mob, if you wanted to exit the mob, these are just a couple of the reasons. In order to get a death sentence, and of course we're talking about roughly 1930 through 1940 is when these guys were doing it, but the biggest things were obviously stealing from your own people, skimming, whatever. You could get killed for skimming a couple dollars if one of the bosses wanted it done. But the worst infraction, the one where you were probably going to be made an example of, is if you were thought to be a stool pigeon. You want to be a rat, whatever you want to call it, that usually got the worst punishment.
Now, when you talk about, we alluded to it, or we mentioned it in the opening, about incineration and ice picks, there are many ways to kill someone. There's been many ways of sending a message. What were these guys sometimes known for? What were they characterized, their behavior, we'll say, of these guys that would kill, especially when it was an informant?
The word psychopathic definitely comes to mind with a few of them. And though I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, when you see these guys go from young men and shooting someone to evolving to the point where they would use an ice pick, for example. And one of the best examples to paint this picture is there was a reporter who wrote an article about one of their murders, and how he characterized it was, if it takes three plunges of an ice pick to kill you, these guys make sure they tack on 50 more plunges of that ice pick for good measure, and then go sit and have a lobster dinner. It was brutal. They made a point of becoming more and more brutal as the years went on.
What's interesting too is that where they basically got some of these guys from, like we talked about in the opening, was from Brooklyn. So tell
right.
us why,
right.
in particular, Brooklyn, and then begin to introduce some of the characters that were the main players in organized crime at that time, like you say, in this era, this decade of horrific murder, and the reign of Murder, Inc., in particular. Name some of the main players in this cast.
Well, these guys, the ones that were the core of what would later be called Murder, Inc., were led by Abe Kid Twist Relis. They were a handful of Jewish guys and Italian guys from Brooklyn. And it could have been any part of New York. And there were guys from the Bronx and other areas, but it just so happened that these guys all sort of joined up their gangs as young men and took out some up-and-coming other gangsters. The really big up-and-coming gangsters saw this happening in Brooklyn, and that's how they became part of it. It could have been anywhere. It just so happened that these guys were particularly well known within Brooklyn and outside of Brooklyn as being constantly arrested and let go for any crime under the sun. They were a gang who liked to be known for what they did. And that caught the attention of guys like Luciano, who was basically a Manhattan gangster, and, you know, Buchalter, who was a racketeer, you know, in the Brooklyn area and beyond. These guys saw this, and that's why they sort of chose them. But other guys, that was Harry Happy Mayone, Harry Pittsburgh, Phil Strauss, Martin Bugsy Goldstein, Frank the Dasher Abbandando, these were the main guys of the group. But they had hired guns that would do maybe one or two jobs that were from other areas, even other parts of the country. This became national. By the mid-1930s, these guys were going all over the country and had contacts in various parts of the country.
Lucky Luciano, tell us about the rise of Lucky Luciano, because there was a couple crime bosses that were obstacles, and so you can tell us about this sort of this conspiracy here, basically, for how he came to power with Mazzaria and Maranzano. So tell us about Mazzaria, Maranzano, Lucky Luciano, and this play for power.
Well, that I sort of did this book to follow up my last one, which was on Luciano, and I kind of knew this would be a fitting following, because what was happening in 1930, 1931, this major mafia boss war, and Lucky Luciano and his buddies, both Italian and Jewish, decided we need to take out both these guys. And you know, obviously I'm oversimplifying this, but here were these young Turks basically saying, we got to get rid of the old school. They knock off both guys by fall of 1931. And at the same time, it was a parallel thing. You had these young guys from Brooklyn who were taking over rackets from other young racketeers. It was like two parallel worlds, on different scales of size. Luciano, Lansky, Costello, Buchalter, all these guys, basically by the end of 1931, had changed the face of organized crime. I mean, some people will argue how much they did or how I'll stand by this. They changed it. It was a whole new era by 1931. And at the same time, these young guys, they knew what was going on with all that too, and they were doing their own little thing. And sooner or later, that gap is bridged. And that's how the Murder, Inc. people hooked up with bosses. Well, by that time, Luciano was a boss. Lansky was a boss, if you want to call it. You know, they were all bosses.
The prosecution, the authorities, the government, they noticed who these people were, despite when we talk about organized crime and a denial in the 60s, in the 50s, I believe,
right,
or in the 40s, that there was such a thing as the mafioso. Authorities knew what was going on here. We're determined to try to take these people to court. Tell us about the state of prosecution at that time in the 30s and some of the attempts, the first attempt to try to take these guys to court and arrest them and have them imprisoned.
With the guys that were in Murder Incorporated, one of the biggest problems that society was dealing with, these guys had money and were developing a lot of backing and had decent lawyers, and they could march in for any infraction and months later be dismissed because witnesses wouldn't come forward or there just wasn't enough evidence. And remember, of course, we're talking about a time before there was any CSI or DNA. So basically, these guys were getting off scot-free, and prosecutors were going after the big fish for the most part. They were going after the Buchalters and Lucianos. That's who they were. They did not know for a decade that those guys had all these underlings carrying out hundreds of deaths that were all connected to the same group. That's where there was this this disconnect. And plus, you don't have, like, today, databases. You know, you had Brooklyn, there would be people here that know about this, but they don't know about it in Manhattan or Queens, necessarily, until it comes out in the newspapers of what happened. So it was very difficult for the judicial system, for law enforcement, to put this all together until 1940.
They're not really known for leaving too much forensic evidence, namely, just, you know, they're well versed in knowing how to dispose of bodies, for the most part.
You would think. It's funny you bring that up, because here's something that happens when you're too much of a narcissist or too cocky. It's going to come back to bite you. These guys got away with a lot, and no, there wasn't a lot of evidence. Bodies were buried in lime pits and dumped in lakes, but some of them reappeared, and these guys were even at times stunned that they weren't, I don't know, as medically versed or scientifically as versed as they thought they were as to what happens to a decomposing body. So, again, that's more of when your head gets too big, you make mistakes, and they did. It's just, I think, Dan, they were very, very lucky for a long time in that they had such a support network to protect them.
Now, you were talking they weren't as well-versed as they might have thought. You give some prime examples. Again, a bit gory, but, hey, that's this program, the audience can handle it. you cited an example of them underestimating their ability to dispose of a body. Just give us that one example of the body they threw in the water.
Well, so they ice-picked a fellow gangster. And I'm going to throw this out there, too. I try to point out in the book, though this doesn't make it right, and society did pay for this, I mean, there's always collateral damage, but really, a lot of their victims were bad guys, too. I just want to point that out. These guys were often killers, too. And one example is Walter Sage. He was one of their friends, fellow gangster, did bad stuff. They thought he was skimming. The order came down, take this guy out. They take him for a ride, ice pick him, I think, 50 sometimes. They tied his body with pieces of metal, throw him in the lake, and a few days later, or actually it was 2 weeks later, tourists are out having fun at the lake, and up pops this bloated body in the middle of the lake. It horrified everybody, and the guys didn't understand what happens with a tiny hole that an ice pick does to a body. It actually ends up sealing itself up and blows up with the gases, and it lifted parts of a car engine when that body came to the surface. That's how they did not understand how that happened. So it just goes to show they were a little too big for their britches, to use a really old school term.
What we're seeing in this almost 100 years ago in 1930s, and anybody that's a big fan like myself and probably a big part of the audience knows this from watching mob stories, is that how do these guys really get to be able to do the kind of hits that they need to get? What I'm saying is that these guys are a suspicious lot. Like you say, these guys are fellow killers and been around these guys who are killers, and so they're cautious. They know the drill. They know what really goes on, and yet they're still hit. How does that happen?
You know, that's maybe the million-dollar question, Dan. I think a lot of these guys were very overconfident, period. And even though you would think you're naturally paranoid and cautious, in my research, and again, none of us were there, we don't know, and just based off general psychology, it seems to me they didn't think anything would happen to them. It's like you walking down the street and just thinking nothing's going to happen to you. It's going to happen to that guy across the street, even when you were part of it. So what happens on top of that, and it's like what we saw in all the mob movies, your buddies are the ones that are going to kill you, and they're friendly. And, of course, that fools you, too. You feel that comfort. So that's what they would do. Murder, Inc. didn't just kill strangers, and they did kill a lot that, you know, they didn't personally know. But they also killed a ton of their own over the years because there's that comfort level. Like the example, Walter Sage, he had no idea. He thought he was going for a ride like he always does with the same guys. It's just he had a contract on his head that day.
Yes. Now, you talk about the Abe Reles gang, Kid Twist, and you also talk about something called the Sullivan, it's the Sullivan Law. And tell us about the Sullivan Sullivan Law and Abe Reles gang, and again, prosecution trying to prosecute these guys effectively and put them in prison.
Okay, the short version of this, in early 30s, a law was instated. There were piggyback laws to disorderly conduct. What they were trying to do is crack down on some organized crime by arresting people in large groups. If they suspected you or your friends were criminals, they could arrest you all and then figure it out later. The law came under some scrutiny, of course, because some judges thought, you know, this isn't right. But what the police thought they could do is grab all of you. Like, they could grab the whole Reles gang just because they, you know, have heard these guys are bad. Bring them in and then try to hold them on vagrancy, which basically means you don't have any money. We can hold you for 100 days, and there's nothing you can do about it. But what happened, that backfired all the time, because these young gangsters had money. They had lawyers, and by then they had impressed people like Lepke and Jacob Shapiro and Luciano. So these guys had a whole network in place of bail. They had houses. They had cars. You couldn't say it was vagrancy. And some judges, even though they knew these guys were bad, their hands were tied. They said, you can't even use this law. So it was a weird time for legal issues as well. I mean, it was quite a dynamic, that whole time period. There were so many factors that went into how Murder, Inc. actually existed and thrived for as long as it did.
Now, you go on with and talk about Mayor Lansky and some of his cohorts and Bugsy Siegel. So tell us a little bit more about Murder, Inc. and how it came to be known as Murder, Inc.
Well, Murder, Inc., the name was definitely a product of the press. Not that it's any different than today in terms of, hey, the most eye-catching, outrageous headlines are what sell, you know, the news. That's what they did. There's definitely been debate over the last century as to where the name Murder, Inc. really originated, and I addressed a couple of the, theories I found in my research over the years that people had discussed of who really came up with it, but it was definitely a name that stuck once, you know, the whole case broke in early 1940. It was quickly dubbed Murder, Inc. Those guys themselves, Dan, they referred to that group as the Combination. That's what they called themselves, were Combination guys. Murder, Inc., again, was, you know, labeled by the press.
Now, you outline a lot of the characters that people have been interested in mob stories would know, of course, like Charles Lucky Luciano and Louis Lepke Buchalter and Mayor Lansky. But you do have quite a bit of information on the, you know, the striking characters that are the gangbusters, as you call them, John Harlan Ayman, Thomas Dewey, William Dickelman, all Burton Turkus. So talk especially about William O'Dwyer and Thomas Dewey, both district attorneys. Tell us a little bit about Thomas Dewey first. Introduce this character.
Well, Dewey was definitely a politician, or he had aspirations. He saw his future by taking down New York's crime lords, and he went after the big fish. He went after Buchalter. He went after Dutch Schultz. He went after Luciano, and he was quite successful on a lot of those levels. And it made a name for him. He was basically a celebrity. And then William O'Dwyer, he came in as the DA for Brooklyn, and he started going after what I put in the book is like the lower tier type of gangsters, but right. It ended up, wow, that was even big. To me, that was even bigger than what Dewey did with the Murder, Inc. But yeah, O'Dwyer came in, and I say a lot of it was luck in how this whole thing unfolded before him, because really it was Burton Turkus, his assistant district attorney, that was the true gangbuster. He was really good too with what he did. I think he opened the door for it. But that's what it took, a lot of people. Just like with the mob, Dan, there's never one person. It's a whole sort of alliance, or where things are just aligned perfectly.
Now, with these lawmen, when do they get an inclination that there is this enforcement arm, and who some of those members might be? When does that happen, and who can you say is most responsible for discovering and putting things together to say, this is this enforcement arm, it's Murder, Inc.? That discovery, who would you attribute that to?
I'd have to say John Harlan. He didn't realize it at the time, but he was the one that really started probing all these guys in the candy shop that they were hanging out. He knew something was really wrong. Something was going on, and that opened the door for O'Dwyer and Dewey to an extent, who was already sort of beyond and going elsewhere. But I really credit John Harlan for cracking that door open. And then O'Dwyer, in the book you'll see there's some controversy even over what he did and didn't do during that. And Burton Turkus, I really think, was the man that totally smashed it.
It's an interesting tale that you have as well, and is very important to the story, is you talked about the candy store and the motherly figure that was the front for it, Rose, I believe. So tell us about the candy store and its importance to this story and to these mobsters.
The Relis gangs, they were called, that became what Murder, Inc. was, they all hung out at a candy store in Brooklyn, which was operated by an illiterate old lady who was, a grandma. And she and her son and some of his cronies ran different rackets out of the joint, or she allowed it, let's say, and she made some nice money from it. These guys eventually made her candy store their office for Murder, Incorporated. There were a lot of people involved. That's why this book, there's so many names, because there really were a lot of people involved. But yes, their ground zero was a candy shop in Brooklyn.
And tell us about law enforcement's discovery of this.
Well, that was definitely John Harlan trying to clean up Brooklyn. They kept hearing these names of Abe Relis and Happy Mayone and Pittsburgh Phil and these guys that were always milling around this place. They knew there was gambling. They knew there was bootlegging. They knew there was prostitution. They knew there was morphine being traffic through there. And when they started to put it all together, they realized, oh, that's why these guys are always hanging out here. This is where they basically take their phone calls from the bosses, telling them, here, you need to take out this person. You need to take out that person. That's really how it all unfolded in the short version.
You also mention a detective named John Osnato. So tell us his importance to this story. What does he do?
Osnato was with O'Dwyer during the very first interrogation of one of Murder, Inc.'s underlings. That what really broke the case open was Osnato and O'Dwyer's little reverse psychology plan to get this young guy named Anthony Duke Maffetor to explain to them what the hell was going on with all these other guys. And it was, I don't want to give away what they did to him, but they eventually got him to talk, and he was the very first one to start naming names, and it was an incredible downfall from that minute on.
Now, we won't give that away, but tell us what the prosecution finally looks like when they, I believe it's 1940, when they finally can attempt to take this to a courtroom and make these charges stick. So tell us about that whole initiative.
Well, very unlike today, and not always for what turned out to be good, but justice was a little more swift. Literally within 3 months of finding out what they thought was going on, they rounded everybody up. Any name that came to mind, they rounded them up, and they immediately started putting 2 to 3 guys on trial together, and they were going straight for the electric chair. That's what the prosecution wanted. So by May of 1940, they had already started putting these guys on trial. It was that fast. And with that, Dan, oddly, where I say there's sort of a downside to this, again, we're not talking about a time where you had a lot of evidence to use. They were basically sending people to the electric chair based on another bad guy's testimony. That is pretty much, and not that these guys weren't really bad and the prosecution knew it, but at the same time, could you imagine that today, where just a couple people get to go on a stand and then they send you the electric chair? It's hard to digest in certain ways.
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't happen now. It wouldn't happen. Now, the thing is, we talked about in the introduction that, and everybody talks about how they only kill their own. If you're an informant, that's the worst offense ever. They have this Murder, Inc. to deal with those informants that would dare defile their bosses and their fellow gangsters and be an informant. And really, the key to the successful prosecution is guys turning informant right from this Murder, Inc. So tell us about the first guys that jump ship and help out the prosecution.
The prosecution, part of it they lucked out, and part of it was very clever thinking that they grabbed the younger guys who were not the biggest players in Murder, Inc., but were very privy to the actions of Murder, Inc. These were young family men. They knew we can probably break them. And because I would say one of the biggest mistakes the Murder, Inc. boys made was having so many extended people involved in one way or another that had knowledge of the worst stuff they did. So the prosecution breaks a couple of the young ones who are always hanging around hear and see everything, so they start talking, naming names. The bigger guys, most of them didn't want to talk except for, and this is where I say there's no or little honor among thieves, the biggest, cruelest, member of the group, Abe Relis himself, decided to save his own skin as well when he heard other people were turning informant, and he was the prosecution's star witness then. So even their boss, their main guy, turned, state's witness against them. So it was definitely a lesson, or, you would think it would be a lesson. There is no honor among thieves.
When these trials began, what was the media response? How was it received? Tell us a little bit about that, about the coverage of the testimony, and tell us about that media response.
That was, it was national, and of course, by the time the press was really all over it. Now, local press was on it, and of course, the term Murder, Inc. was, labeled. That was it. Then everybody was using it. But once the news broke that these guys were national, traveled around to do hits, it became one of the most sensational stories of that era. Now, there were definitely a few, you had the Lindbergh baby thing going on, and of course the war was going on. This was a sensational filler for sure. But yeah, especially in New York, obviously, because you can imagine being there at that time and just not being able to fathom how extensive this was, unless you were part of it or lived through it. Maybe some of those people weren't surprised.
So who is the, you say Abe Relis, Kid Twist, is their star witness. What's he like on the stand when he finally gets there? What's his demeanor like? How does he act? Is he a good witness? And what kind of information is he providing? Tell us about the details of that interaction.
In terms of going up on the witness stand and delivering testimony, he was good in the sense that he told everything. What was creepy and odd about it is that he was very nonchalant, even in his own actions that he admitted to. And there were moments where that was even questionable. What drew some controversy or detractors against the prosecution was just that. How can you use a guy that admitted to basically killing someone in his own house while his mother-in-law was asleep in the next room? How can you use this guy and expect, anybody to feel something when he's your star witness? So it's a double-edged sword, but was he good? Yeah, the prosecution thought he was a godsend because he was the boss of that group, and he told on all of them.
Yeah, incredible. Now, how effective are they in terms of actual numbers? You say this would not happen now, and I would agree with you that there's no way that this stuff would happen, especially in short order. So tell us about how many of those people are convicted by these techniques or in these courts. And so tell us about sort of their success rate.
Well, when you look at the whole picture, and these trials went on for several years, at first it looked good because immediately they were getting death sentences for the main guys, okay, like real quick. But then those went into appeals, and it almost looked for a moment like some of them might have, got a reprieve. What ended up happening, though, with a lot of these other, I want to say the extended members, a lot of them oddly walked. Some of them were given death sentences and were able to not only walk away from that, walk out of jail. It was not, I think the prosecution was happy, Dan, in that they got the main poster boys, but they didn't get a lot of the extended players. These guys, a lot of them lucked out, either got a few years in jail or got out of the death sentence altogether. Some got no jail time. So you never know what's going to happen in a court of law. You know, everybody knows that. You never know what's going to happen.
Right. And you say some people that deserved Dole Sparky there didn't get their chair and ended up really well. So you do talk about and chronicle the ones that did quite well and the guys that didn't do well at all. When you say some of these death penalties were carried out in fairly short order compared to some of the states now that have taken, you know, 15 years on death row. So
right, right. Yeah, and regardless of how you feel about the death penalty, well, yeah, the wait is way too long now, I guess, and back then it was way too quick. I'll say this, the one trial that I personally think was questionable, to say the least, was Lepke, Louis Capone, and Mendy Weiss. Now, those three were put on trial, and they were all executed together, but there is plenty to show. I don't know that they really should have executed Lepke. I mean, though he was the boss and called these orders in, it was weird. And the other two guys were basically bad guys too, but the ones that really did the crime that they put him on trial for weren't even on trial for that crime. It was a weird thing, Dan. And I'm not a lawyer or a judge, but I look at it like, wow, that one, I think they just wanted to fry everybody. And what ended up happening is a couple years later, a lot of the guys that they still thought were going to go to jail or whatever walked free and either retired or became criminals in a different realm. So to me, the prosecution really didn't win in the end anyway.
Were there any players that arose in terms of defense of some of these gangsters? You say the tide turned in the 4 years of these trials or so, that
right.
It looked really good and then not so.
Well, what happens? Right, they think they have such a strong case, and they did. And how else can I put this? They blew it all on the first few trials, and they got their death sentences. But when it came to all the extended bunch, they ended up not really having as much as they wanted because certain witnesses all of a sudden were like, I don't remember, or I didn't, you know, I'm not sure it was him. And then defenses became a little better, a little more savvy to it, and got reduced sentences for plea bargains. And all of a sudden, people were going free or getting a few years in prison. No, don't get me wrong, some of them did end up dying in prison anyway, but there were more than a handful that ended up walking, and that's why later in the book I have a little section called, you know, Whatever Happened To. Some of the stories I could find about these people, the post-Murder, Inc. hype.
Yeah, well, let's talk about one of those stories, too, because one of them I thought was very interesting, and I probably see this stuff regurgitated or recycled in fictional accounts, about the wife that believed she knew who had killed her husband, testified or went to the police, and then at some point recanted that or had some kind of memory lapse. Tell us about that.
Oh, there are a few cases of that. One of the best ones has to be Elsie Feinstein. She was married to a guy named Sam Feinstein. He was involved with the Murder, Inc. guys, decided he wanted to go straight, and he started verbally expressing that. Well, that was a bad move, and one day Sam goes for a ride, and he doesn't come back. The guys from Murder, Inc. then provided Elsie with $50 in an envelope every week. Well, once the Murder, Inc. trial started, they brought Elsie in and questioned her. And she acknowledged that her husband disappeared. They didn't, you know, they didn't know where he was, and that she was getting $50 a week from the mob. However, it was brought to the attention of prosecutors that she was not telling the whole story.
And go on. What was the whole story?
Sorry. One of the state's witnesses, Albert TikTok Tannenbaum, had a 16-millimeter film of Elsie frolicking on a beach with three or four members of Murder Incorporated. He brings this into the prosecutors, and what really had to be one of the first ever used cases of sex lies and videotape. This guy had a home movie of them partying on a Miami beach, and his assistant DA, Burton Turkus, described what he saw. He said Elsie frolicking around in a bikini the size of two handkerchiefs with all the guys that basically killed her husband. So they presented this to her. She tried to say it wasn't her. They locked her up for a few months, and then she had a change of heart and admitted that, you know, yeah, my husband was probably killed by them, and I partied in Miami with all of them. Yeah, it was just, truth is stranger than fiction. It's just crazy stories. That's what I tried to do with this book, is give all this the wild side stuff that isn't as covered as much.
Yeah, the other thing, too, was this is another one I've read as well, and, you know, I'm a big fan of The Sopranos. And right out of real life, right out of true crime, you talk about a hit on the wrong person. Tell us about that story, which is fascinating.
They wanted to take out somebody involved with unions and, you know, strong-arming unions, and Lepke decided a contract needed to be put out on this guy. They sent Jack Parisi, Seymour Magoon, and Cuppy Migden to go take this guy out. Cuppy Migden says, oh, I know who he is. I'll point him out. Jack Parisi's going to shoot him. Well, here comes this guy out of his apartment, walking down the street to go to work. Parisi blasts them. They get in the car, they go home, and find out a day later they killed a completely innocent guy who happened to physically look like the guy they were supposed to hit and lived in the same building. So that was an epic fail on their part. But back to your earlier about guys that ended up getting off, you know what? All three of the men involved basically skated from that one. That was a perfect example. One turned state's witness, one hid for a few years, the other hid for 10 years, and then when they were caught, they ended up getting off of everything. Anyway, it was just, again, you just can't make this stuff up, how this all went down.
Yeah, you include what happens to Cuppy. They're not too happy with his eyewitness account of who the victim was supposed to be.
No, and it's amazing he didn't get killed just for, you know, messing up that so bad. But you know what? You blame them all. It's the whole thing. These guys thought they knew everything. They really did. And granted, a lot of times when they didn't know who a guy was and were told or shown a picture, they were successful a lot of times. But for the most part, again, there's such an arrogance. I think it's one of the most fascinating parts of the whole story is the unbelievable narcissism across the board with these guys.
Now, you talk about Murder, Inc. being this unprecedented, you know, murderous group that rose to prominence and carried out all these assassinations. After this trial in the 40s, beginning in 1940, did organized crime, obviously organized crime, the membership changes all the time. That's one thing about it, always fresh members.
Right.
But did the landscape change in terms of, did they learn any lesson from having this enforcement arm go so public and be so such a loose cannon, such an overkill and so much attention from the authorities? And so tell us if they learned anything, and did they conduct themselves differently after this?
I would have to say absolutely they did. I mean, there was actual discussions or, you know, gangland lore that, you know, some of the even top bosses didn't really like how it was going on anyway, that the ones that were a little more diplomatic. And then there's some debate that even the diplomatic ones still thought you needed, you know, a killer arm. It's just it got out of hand. And also, you're talking about by 1940, a lot, you know, Lepke was executed, well, you know, by the mid-40s. Luciano was already in jail. Meyer Lansky, he always kind of tried to stay under the radar. Frank Costello, you know, was shaking hands with everybody, so he stayed out of a lot of trouble. But you also had the actual mafia was had evolved from 1930 on into the five families. So there was a whole new dynamic that I would imagine had learned a lot of lessons from what Murder, Inc. did. It's, and here's the other thing, Dan. When Murder, Inc. ended, I don't even like to say it ended because it didn't just end. People didn't stop getting killed. It was that 10-year span ended, but there were still things that lagged and carried over, you know, even to the mafia as it rose. And then when the Jewish faction sort of assimilated more into legitimate society, you know, it was a change. Like you said, it was a change of guard membership, the way it worked.
I'll ask this question too. Did prosecution learn anything from the, again, some of the missteps that they did in this almost 15 years of trying to prosecute these gangsters? Did they learn anything? Did they make any headway themselves in terms of changing the laws to accommodate themselves when they're trying to prosecute these guys?
Absolutely. And I think it took a long time for it really to come in. And I'll go as far as say, like, the RICO Act, late, you know, many, many years later. But what happened in the early 1950s is this didn't die in the eyes of some of these Senate committees. They really wanted to know how things went well and how things went badly with the Murder, Inc. trials. And they were calling people, a lot of people, before them to question and say, hey, you know, how did this get screwed up here? And why did this happen here? So it didn't just die, and I do think it improved, you know, law enforcement and, you know, how the laws were applied to things. Yeah, you had, from that decade, Dan, my God, so many missteps and wacky stuff. They definitely learned.
What we didn't talk about is that there were some spectacular finds, burial grounds, shallow graves. Tell us a little bit about what you talk about in the book about some of these discoveries.
Well, that is definitely a fascinating part of it. Again, for almost 10 years, all these people disappear, and nobody's putting two and two together. And it was very hard to. There was no way to really put two and two together. Once they did in 1940, and witnesses were taking them to dumping grounds in the Catskills, there were properties and lakes, and yes, lime pits with bodies. New Jersey, they were getting rid of the cars where they murdered people in pieces in junkyards throughout Brooklyn. Everything was being disposed of, but nothing is truly gone. So by the end of 1942, they had found not all, and that's why we'll never know how many people they really killed, but they did find a hell of a lot of bodies and car parts and other things that were related to these killings based on witnesses remembering and saying, hey, let's take a ride. I'll show you where they dumped a bunch up in Sullivan, you know, or Monticello, New York. Yeah, it was crazy stuff.
One of the great aspects of your book is the photos that you were able to get. I mean, the incredible amount of photos and the quality of these photos are just incredible, the stuff. If you're ever interested in this stuff, you've got this incredible collection. So tell us about this incredible collection. Where was this, your source? And tell us a little bit more about the photos that you've included.
All right. Well, first, I have to give credit where credit is due. I really got hooked on acquiring these kind of things from a colleague of mine, Arthur Nash. His book just that did it. I was hooked like a crack addict. Then I started going after these, and what I ended up doing is getting every press photo or police photo mugshots of these guys, and what it evolved into was not just getting photos of crime scenes and these guys, but also the locations. Because back then, newspaper photographers took pictures of everything, not just, you know, somebody walking in handcuffs. Like an example, the picture of the junkyard. To me, that may seem like nothing special, but to me, that's one of my prized in the collection. It's like the actual junkyard search from Murder, Inc. Yeah, I have this. It's my other main thing. I like to say I'm a writer, and I also like to say I'm a curator of weird stuff, Dan.
Yeah, I noticed that you said your private collection, so I said, interesting, very interesting.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Now, with this book, has there been any, have you ever get any gangsters, mobsters, guys kind of disputing some of the things that are in the book? And with this book, was there any contact at all like that, any kind of anecdote that you might be able to pass on?
No, with this one, nothing, not in the way of detractors, which, and that's fine, too. Anybody, I love to, you know, find out where we were all wrong or whatever, you know, when you write one of these books, because we weren't there. But most of these people are dead. What was fascinating is that I did, another colleague and friend of mine, Michael Bourdin, his grandmother's story with Happy Mahone, and letting me use a photograph of her and telling me how she, you know, just passed away a couple of years ago and used to talk about these guys. She knew them. And that was incredible. The only book, and when I wrote Diary of a Motor City Hitman, now there were people that were still alive from the 70s that were that book, but most of them were just very happy that the book was written, and I was cleared up on some things that were incorrect and all that, which was great. But no, I've never had anybody like really detract yet.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
Interesting. So now, what did you find anything surprising after all the research you did on this and being, you know, basically for better term, you know, an organized crime expert here from the research that you've done and the books that you've written? Was there anything really surprising, really surprising to you after writing this book?
No, I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice, Dan. I've been fascinated with all this stuff for 20-some years, and yeah, I was surprised at every turn, and partially because it puts you in your place, and you're like, oh, wow, I thought I knew that, you know, everything, and you don't. But what really surprised me the most, and maybe it's not in the terms of, oh, my God, that's shocking. It was really the question that I wanted to answer but didn't know what question I was asking myself when I was writing the book. And that was, what did these guys really, really think of themselves? And when I found the quote, which you probably saw, and I'm not going to say what it is, that Bugsy Goldstein gave in the early 1930s to a cop and a reporter, I think it totally answered the million-dollar question. What did these guys see of themselves, and what were they aspiring to? That was the most shocking, to actually find, wow, there's the, you know, they actually said they thought.
Yeah, systemic.
So that to me, oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, incredible. So now, for people that would like to know more about this, do you have a website? Do you do Facebook? Tell us how people might contact you or find out more information about you and the other books that you have written.
Sure. My website is ganglandlegends.com. I'm on Twitter at Sip the Scallion. That's C-I-P the Scallion. I'm on Facebook. Look me up. I welcome questions, comments, complaints, anything. I love it. I love to hear what people think or have to offer. And I certainly hope if anybody looks at my books, it makes them want to go find out more from whatever source. That's part of what I do. So I love it. Yeah, come visit. Say hi.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this, Mysteries of the Mob's Most Deadly Hit Squad. I mean, a lot of us have talked, and not talked about it, but basically know We think we know about Murder, Inc. It's finally good to hear the lowdown on this. And for anybody who was interested this evening, we did leave a lot of things out. We didn't. There's a lot of spoilers here that we didn't leave. We didn't give everything away. So there's a lot of information in here that'll just blow your mind. And like I say, there's so many stories here that, wow, I thought that was a fictional story, but no, sure as heck, it's a true life story. So again, I want to thank you very much for a great book, Murder, Inc., and for coming on and discussing it with us this evening. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure.
Okay, you have yourself a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.